From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Mati Friedman wasn't necessarily looking for a four-year writing project when he came upon the Aleppo Codex. In the basement of a museum in Israel, he really stumbled upon this ancient book. It was the oldest and most complete text of the Hebrew Bible. And it wasn't flashy, no gold leaf or intricate binding, but he did sense a certain air of dignity to it. So he began to unravel the story of the book, and what he found represents a real-life mystery with shady characters and plot turns that involve betrayal and conspiracies and deceit. But Friedman's book has also been called a meditation on history and myth. Today in the program, he'll join us to tell the story of one of the most important books on Earth. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the journalist Mati Friedman happened upon the most perfect copy of the Hebrew Bible ever written. It was in an underground room in a museum in Israel, and like so many others before him, Friedman has said he's become captivated by the book, and he began to explore the story behind it. He says at first he thought the story about the power of this book, that was the story, he said, and in fact he says it still is, but the story became far darker than he'd originally intended. What he found represents a real-life mystery with shady characters and plot turns that involve betrayal and conspiracy and deceit. Friedman's book has also been called a meditation on history and myth, and today in the program, Mati Friedman is joining us to talk about his book. It's called The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mati Friedman is a reporter with the Times of Israel. He's also been a correspondent for the Associated Press, where he specialized in religion and archaeology in Israel. He's joining us today from a studio in Jerusalem. And Mati Friedman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I guess I wanted to begin. I mentioned the beginnings of this story, and I want to have you talk a little bit more about this. This is the summer of 2008, as you say in the book. It's when you really happened upon the Aleppo Codex. As I said, it was in the room of a basement in the National Museum in Jerusalem, there in Israel. And at the time, you knew nothing about the book.
That's right. It was the summer of 2008. I was a correspondent at the time with the Jerusalem Bureau of the Associated Press, and I was at the museum in the gallery where the Dead Sea Scrolls are kept. It's called the Shrine of the Book, and of course, everyone's heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're the celebrities of the Hebrew manuscript world. And I walked down a flight of stairs into a dark gallery underneath the gallery where the Dead Sea Scrolls are kept, and I encountered another book. And I understood from the labels that this book was Judaism's most important manuscript, that it was the perfect copy of the Bible in Hebrew. And I had never heard of it. It was called the Aleppo Codex. And that strange gap between its importance and its anonymity really intrigued me. And I decided I would write something about it. And initially, I wrote a pretty standard news feature about the manuscript, about 1,300 words. Mm. And when I started digging deeper later on into the story, I found that at least some of what I had written in that original article, which was based on the official information that was in circulation at the time, was wrong.
Yeah. In your book, you say that when you first came upon the Aleppo Codex there in the museum, that you detected a certain air of dignity about it. How do you describe that? What do you mean by that?
That's what I loved about the Aleppo Codex. There are far more spectacular manuscripts. There are manuscripts that have illuminations in gold leaf and scarlet and blue and yellow, and there are manuscripts that have very elaborate bindings with jewels on the cover. And the Aleppo Codex has none of those things. The Aleppo Codex is just parchment pages with dark brown Hebrew script on a light brown background.
Right.
Three columns per page, 28 lines per column. It's just text. And it struck me in the gallery that this was a manuscript that didn't need to beg for your attention. It was above that. It didn't need bells and whistles. Mm. Its content was enough.
Were you at all surprised, as you began digging, in the kinds of obsessions and passions that books can become for some people? Because it seems like in many ways, I don't know if it's a theme in your life, but certainly it's something that you've written a lot about. You are interested in these ancient documents and the stories behind them.
Yes, and even more than I'm interested in the ancient documents or ancient artifacts that I cover when I read about archaeology, I'm interested in what they do to human beings. Yeah. That's where my real interest lies. And this book, the Aleppo Codex, is less about the Aleppo Codex than it is about what the Aleppo Codex has done to people over a period of about 1,100 years. Mm. Books have power, and they can cause us to do things, and they can cause us, of course, to do good things, and they can cause us to do bad things. And the Aleppo Codex has done both. And that theme is of great interest to me. And one of my favorite books is The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, which is very much about the power of a hidden book and what it does to the monks at a medieval monastery. And I cite Eco at the beginning of my book because that theme is so interesting to me, and it's very much alive in the story of the Aleppo Codex.
Do you think this project became personal for you in maybe unexpected ways? I mean, you write in your book that you had discovered this kind of motivation to make this story, which was fragmented, really, that you wanted to make it whole. And that in some way, and this is how you put it in the book, you say you owed it to the people who had written it and had, you know, guarded it and protected it.
I did come to feel that way. As a journalist, I cover many, many different topics. Usually I spend several days or at most weeks on a topic, and then I move on. I spent 4 years with the Aleppo Codex, and we developed a very close personal relationship. It was probably one-sided. Right. I'm not sure the Aleppo Codex really reciprocated, but I certainly became very attached to it, and I began taking it personally that it had been forgotten, that it had been neglected, and that its story had never been properly told, that the story existed in fragments that were all over the place, but no one had ever gone and picked up all these fragments and told the story of this great manuscript, which people had guarded literally with their lives for more than a millennium. And yes, it became a personal mission. I decided that I would tell the story of the Aleppo Codex in full, no matter what difficulties I encountered along the way. And I am satisfied to have done so in this book, which was published 3 months ago.
You know, there's another interesting theme running through your book. I'm not sure quite how to describe it, but it seems like it's about, in many ways, because you keep referring to this, and that's the kind of ancient and modern relationship between Jews and Muslims, or Jews in the Arab world, you know, where Jews had, Aleppo is a terrific example, because they had lived among Muslims for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And that seems to be kind of a theme in the book. Is that getting it right in some way?
Certainly, and I learned a lot about that through the research I did for this book. I didn't know enough about it before. I'm almost embarrassed to admit how little I knew. In Aleppo, there had been an ancient Jewish community, a Jewish community that was several centuries old at the time that the Second Temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by Roman legions in 70 AD. So we're talking about an ancient, ancient Jewish community. By the time Islam is born, Jews have been in Aleppo for about 1,000 years. And of course, Jews go on to live among Muslims and under Muslim rule from the rise of Islam to the mid-20th century, when that whole Jewish world in Islamic lands collapses and disappears, and about 850,000 Jews who lived in these countries fled their homes in the 20th century and are no longer there, and that whole world vanished. And it's not really mourned by anyone. We're very conscious, certainly in North America, of the Jewish world of Europe, which is the origin of most Jews in America or in Canada, which is where I'm from. But we're not really aware of this Jewish world in Islamic lands, which was much older than the Jewish world of Europe and which was native. The Jews of Aleppo were natives. They didn't immigrate from anywhere. They had been there for more than 2,000 years at the time that their community came to an end. And I learned a lot about that. That's perhaps one of the richest things that I learned while writing this book. And it had, you know, not directly connected to the manuscript, but a very, very important subject matter.
I kept thinking also about how Muslim. It was Muslims that helped the Jews defend Jerusalem against the Crusaders. It was Muslims who were pushing back against the people who were rioting in those days after, which we'll get to, in the United Nations vote that partitioned Palestine. I mean, you kept seeing this connection, which was really interesting in the book.
Yes. The episode that you mentioned, the Crusades, was astonishing to me when I discovered it. When the first crusade arrives in Jerusalem in 1099, there are crusader accounts that tell us that on the walls of Muslim Jerusalem, some of the defenders were Jews. And there's another account from a battle at Haifa, which is a coastal city in northern Israel, that there too the crusaders encountered Jews defending the city alongside Muslims. So you had a Jewish world that was very, very much a part of the Islamic world that existed in this part of the globe at that time. Mm.
So let's lay the groundwork for the story, because the important context for the Aleppo Codex is 1947, November 1947, the United Nations is voting on this creation, essentially, of the State of Israel, partitioning Palestine. And that's kind of where the story of the modern journey, I guess, of the Aleppo Codex starts.
That's right. That November 1947 is the pivotal moment in the Codex's history in modern times, specifically November 29th of that month. And that was the day that this new world organization called the United Nations, which had just been founded, gathered to make what was to be its first significant decision. They were going to vote on whether to partition the British Mandate territory of Palestine into two states, one for Jews and one for Arabs. And the partition vote, as it is known, is one of the key events of 20th century history. As we now know, the United Nations votes for partition. They vote to create these two states. And that leads to a chain of events with which many of us are familiar. There's a war that breaks out in Palestine. The State of Israel is founded, and we're familiar with those events. But yeah, that's the same vote also triggered a chain of events with which not many of us are familiar, which is the story of the Aleppo Codex, because that vote in New York at Flushing Meadow, just outside New York, had very dramatic consequences for the manuscript, which at that time had been held in the Great Synagogue of Aleppo for 600 years.
Mm. You know, so interesting how over the past few days, we've been hearing of Aleppo, Syria, one of the settings for the conflict, of course, there. But as you say in the book, Jewish Aleppo is gone, and it was once, and for, as you said, hundreds of years, a place for the Aleppo Jews. And so you have this Jewish community with this ancient and rich history in this place, and they have synagogues, and they have sacred texts, and they have shops, of course, and schools. And then comes this vote, and then come these riots, and everything changes, I guess, Marty Friedman, in the matter of a couple of days.
Yes. I mean, there had been a more gradual erosion of the Jews' position in Arab countries in the decades leading up to the partition vote. And that was linked to the rise of nationalism in the Middle East. And there are two parallel developments which are quite interesting. And on the one hand, you have the rise of Jewish nationalism, which is called Zionism.
Right.
And Jews from Europe mostly begin establishing a Jewish presence in Palestine, which the Jews see as their ancient homeland. And at the same time, in the Arab world, there's an emerging national consciousness. And this national consciousness among Arabs can make room for Christian Arabs, but it doesn't have room for Jewish Arabs. So the Jews are excluded. And the Jews become very dependent on the colonial powers which rule most of the Middle East, France, in the case of Syria. And the Jews become identified with the colonial power. And this leads to simmering tensions over decades, and it kind of bursts, it explodes after the UN vote in 1947, which leads to riots across the Arab world, and it eventually leads to the disappearance of the Jewish world that existed in Arab lands.
Mm. Tell us about the Great Synagogue in Aleppo, because the place gets trashed, basically, by the riots.
The Great Synagogue of Aleppo was in the old city of Aleppo in the Jewish quarter. It's actually still there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it's doing today in the midst of all the violence in Aleppo. But when I checked, the synagogue existed. It was kept under lock and key by the regime, and it could be visited with the permission of the regime. Of course, there are no Jews in Aleppo today. Yeah. This ancient synagogue was the nerve center of the life of the Jewish community of Aleppo, and it was an ancient building with dark chambers and grottos and chandeliers and a courtyard, a great Oriental building. In a dark grotto down a few steps in the synagogue grotto that was called the Cave of Elijah the Prophet was a safe with two locks. And it had two locks so that two elders of the community would have to be present to open the safe. It wasn't enough that one could be present. That was an additional security measure. And inside the safe was the Aleppo Codex, which had been kept in this grotto since the 14th century, so 600 years in the Aleppo synagogue at the time of this riot, the day after the UN vote at Flushing Meadow. The riot sees mobs of Syrians burning Jewish homes and burning Jewish businesses. They burn 18 synagogues, and one of the synagogues is the Great Synagogue of Aleppo, and it's badly damaged, and the Codex disappears.
Yeah. Which we'll get to that story, of course. I guess I want to back up a little bit, as you do in the book, to talk about some of the history of the Aleppo Codex. Or they called it the crown because of how perfect it was. What made the crown so special? I mean, it wasn't necessarily its beauty. One rabbi had said, and you mentioned this in your book, that it was from beginning to end, it was the same. It was the same writing. That was the thing that really, I guess, made it special.
His point was very interesting, and I hadn't thought of it. But if you look at a lot of medieval manuscripts, the handwriting changes. Sometimes it can be a bit sloppy. The size of the letters might change, or the lines might not be straight. The Aleppo Codex, which consisted of 500 parchment pages at the time it was written and more than 300,000 words, might have been run off on a laser printer. Yeah. It was written by an expert scribe whose handwriting was perfect throughout the entire manuscript, and that is quite striking. But what makes the Aleppo Codex important is less the beauty of the script than the content. And to understand why the content of the Aleppo Codex is so important, it's useful to go back about 9 centuries before it was written. Yeah. It was written in about 930 AD, but 9 centuries before, the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD. And until that point, the Jews had lived in the same country, and they'd spoken the same language, and they'd been bound by the same political system and by the temple. And that all changes, and Jewish communities begin to be scattered across the world. And eventually they're going to be in Tehran, and they're going to be in Warsaw, and they're going to be in New York, and they're going to be in San Diego. And nothing is holding these people together because they're speaking different languages, and they answer to different kings, and they're not the same people anymore. And if they're to survive as a people, there needs to be something holding them together. And what emerges is a revolutionary idea that a scattered people will be held together by a book. Yeah. They'll be held together by the written word, by a book that they're all going to read together. And that book is the Hebrew Bible. And for that to work, you need there to be an agreed upon version of the text, because the nature of a holy text, which is subject to scrutiny and interpretation, is that if there's a minor difference in one of the passages, that could lead to a splintering of the faith. Mm. You can't have any differences in the text, and you need a master copy. And the creation of the master copy of the Hebrew Bible takes hundreds of years. It is centered on the city of Tiberias, which is on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, which is a center for Jewish scholarship in those years. They develop a system of writing vowels, because Hebrew, like Arabic and other Semitic languages, is written largely without vowels. They develop a system of writing musical notes to which the text is supposed to be chanted, which is also punctuation, which is very important. There's no punctuation until that point. And the crowning achievement of that process, the manuscript that marks the end of the perfection of the Hebrew Bible, is the manuscript we know as the Aleppo Codex, which is written around 930 AD in Tiberias.
Mm. I was so interested in the way it was written. Shlomo ben Boyaya, did I get that about right?
Shlomo ben Boyaya was the scribe who wrote the Codex.
And you say, talk about how it works, because you envision how he would have sat on the floor or on a mattress, and he would have had a wooden plank on his knees, and he would have spread out this parchment. and he would have written this down. But there was a master who, and this is really intriguing. Aaron Ben Asher was the master related to the codex, who knew this by heart, consonant and vowel, you say.
That's right. Ben Boyah was the scribe, and he was obviously a tremendous scribe, but he was basically a technician. Yeah. He was doing as he was told. The mind behind the Aleppo Codex is the descendant of the most illustrious family of Jewish scholars involved in this process of perfecting the Bible, which is the Ben Asher dynasty. And he's the last and greatest scholar of the dynasty, Aaron Ben Asher, as you mentioned. It's quite clear that he knows the entire Bible, all 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, off by heart. And he is the...
How's that possible, by the way?
He's the guy in charge.
I mean, was it an oral tradition? Did they sing it? I mean, was it committed to memory early on? Were they trained for that? That's amazing.
I think everything you said is probably true. It was certainly, very much an oral tradition that was kept alive in people's minds, because until that point, you didn't have a Bible that included all the information you needed to read it. So you might have a copy of the book of Jeremiah, for example.
Yeah.
But in the scroll, you wouldn't have the vowels or the punctuation, and you wouldn't have the notes. Mm. So even if you had the scroll, someone had to remember all of that information. And before the Aleppo Codex was written, we don't have any copies of the entire Hebrew Bible at all. The Codex is the oldest known copy of the entire Bible. As far as we know, it marks the first time the Hebrew Bible was written together as one book. It's a very key point in the evolution of this great book from an oral tradition into a written book, the book that we have today.
Mm. And it's not a scroll. It's a book. It was not meant, as you say, as a ritual object. It was meant as you use this. It had really practical use.
That's one of the interesting things about the Codex. For ritual use in synagogues, you need the Bible, the Torah, the five books of Moses, which is the first part of the Hebrew Bible and the most important part. It needs to be a scroll. And to this day, if you go to a synagogue, you'll see them reading the Torah from a scroll. But a scroll is very clumsy if you're a scholar. If you need to flip from Genesis to Deuteronomy, it could take you 10 minutes to roll the scroll. And the Codex had been invented centuries before, and it was an innovation that allowed you to flip very easily among places in the book. The Codex was not intended for ritual use because religious law required scrolls to be used in synagogues.
Right.
It was supposed to be a scholarly resource. It was supposed to be the source for the copying of all future Bibles. It was designed to be copied as much as possible. And it was supposed to be consulted as much as possible by Bible scholars. That was the reason the Codex was created.
But there it is. It ends up in this grotto in the synagogue in Aleppo. And you need two keys to get it open, you know, the two rabbis to consent to open it. Did they open it very often? Did anyone ever see it very often? Was it ever used very often in those years?
An interesting thing happens to the Codex. It's created for the express purpose of being copied as much as possible. But as time goes by in Aleppo, it becomes less a scholarly resource than an icon, almost a sacred object that is believed to protect the community from harm. And there's an interesting tension in religion, not only in Judaism, but in a lot of religions, where human beings get confused between the meaning of an object and the object itself. So looking at the Western Wall here in Jerusalem, for example, some people will tell you that the stones of the Western Wall are holy.
Yeah.
And some people will say, no, these stones are not holy. They represent something that is holy, and they remind us of something that is holy, so they can connect us to the divine, but the stones are stones. And the Aleppo Codex, of course, is important because of its content. It contains the text of the perfect Bible in Hebrew, but humans tend to get confused about that. So they know this is a very, very important book, and over time it becomes about the physicality of the book. Mm-hmm. This physical object in the safe is what's important, and it becomes not only venerated, it becomes valuable. And not only is the book valuable, not only does it have great monetary worth, but its individual pages have value. If you have a page of the Codex, it might protect you, just as the book protected the Jews of Aleppo, and that tragic human confusion is the book's downfall.
Because they connected this book to their identity, but also to their fate, that if something happened to it, something would happen to to us, I guess.
That is the belief that emerged in the Aleppo community, that if anything happened to this great book, if it was ever taken from the great synagogue, the community would be destroyed. And I spent a lot of time in the past couple of years talking to elderly people from Aleppo, Jewish people from Aleppo, of course, no longer live there. And they would tell me this story, and of course, it's a superstition, so they might chuckle, but then they would always get a serious look on their face, and they'd say, but you know that's what happened. Mm. The book was moved from the synagogue, and the community was destroyed. And these stories, superstitions, and there were others that were woven around the codex over hundreds of years, we might laugh at them, but those stories are what protected this manuscript. The manuscript survived in almost perfect condition for more than 1,000 years. And it did so without the Jews who were in charge of it having any political power. So they didn't have an army to protect the manuscript. There were no endowed monasteries. Mm. They never had political power. The only way they could protect the manuscript was with their belief. And with these stories, they wove a protective web of stories around the manuscript, and it proved to be a remarkably effective tool, which is the reason that this manuscript survived in good condition for as long as it did.
Mari Friedman is with us. He's a reporter with the Times of Israel. His book is called The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about an amazing story about a book. It's an ancient Hebrew Bible, considered the most perfect copy ever written. The journalist Mari Friedman has written a sort of detective story about the text. It's called the Aleppo Codex. It was kept in the dark grotto of a synagogue in Syria for hundreds of years. And the story of how it ended up there and then how it ended up eventually in Israel is really the great story told in his book called The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. You can join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we get to Aleppo in 1947, and the riots really gut these Jewish houses of prayer and shops and schools and homes and And I guess talk about how where the story of because this is sort of the official version of the story. What is the story as to what happens to the Codex, the Aleppo Codex?
The official version of the story, which is what I knew when I began writing about the Codex, was that the book was damaged in the fire. It was spirited into hiding and kept for 10 years in a storeroom in one of the Aleppo bazaars, a storeroom owned by a Jewish merchant. Yeah. And after the fire in the synagogue, there had initially been a rumor that the book had been destroyed altogether. Mm-hmm. And the rumors reach Israel, and a Bible scholar writes a very interesting, heartbroken obituary for the Aleppo Codex, which is quite fascinating, especially because this is the middle of Israel's war of independence, yeah, and real people are actually dying. And the scholar is heartbroken over the loss of this book, which is understandable because of a fact that we haven't mentioned yet, which is that there are no copies of this book.
Of course.
In the mid-20th century, the book has never been photographed. There are no known copies of the Aleppo Codex, Judaism's most important manuscript. The perfect copy of the Hebrew Bible exists only in the original. So if the original is lost, the information inside is gone. And it is thought that that is what has happened. But it emerges that the story of the Codex's destruction was, in fact, a lie that had been engineered by the elders of the Jewish community in Aleppo, who knew that the Syrian government was trying to put its hands on the Codex, which was known to be very valuable and important. And in order to throw off government agents, they made up this story that the Codex had been lost in the synagogue fire. And the Codex is spirited from the synagogue and hidden for 10 years. And in 1957, when it's clear that the Aleppo community, the Jewish community of Aleppo, is doomed and is not going to recover, the rabbis of Aleppo, two rabbis, two chief rabbis of the community, decide that they're going to send this book out of Aleppo for the first time in 600 years, and they're going to send it to Israel, to the president of Israel at the time, whose name is Yitzhak Ben Tzvi. So according to the official version, the book is damaged in the fire, hidden in Aleppo, and then sent to Israel and given to Israel's president, who has founded an institute for the study of the Jewish communities of the East called the Ben Tzvi Institute. That institute remains the custodian of the Codex to this day.
At what point, Mari Friedman, because that was the official version, that's the story most people sort of bought for years and years. What was it about the story that seemed kind of fishy for you? Because you started to become suspicious about these official versions of these stories. And it seems like the more, because you talk about this in the book, the more you are asking for particulars. It was okay when you were asking about general questions about the Codex. But then you started getting specific and you say people stopped returning your emails, people started getting dismissive, not interested in. When did you start detecting something is not right here?
My reporter's sense began to buzz when people didn't want to talk to me. I was pretty naive at the beginning. I thought people would be very happy that I was calling and inquiring about this manuscript, which no one had really done anything with for years and years. And I was quite surprised when people didn't want to answer my questions or were very vague and evasive. And that included pretty much everyone at the beginning, academics and Jewish exiles from Aleppo. And I understood eventually that there was a story here that was being concealed. And it took a long time. But eventually I managed to put together enough fragments of the story that I understood what had happened. And the story of the Codex was illuminated, and it was quite different than the official version of the story, which I had known at the beginning. Mm.
We should explain, you mentioned that there was like it was the only copy. Which is an interesting story because, as you say in the book, even before the riots destroyed the synagogue in Aleppo, Jews had been trying to get their hands on the Codex. Scholars wanted to produce their own edition of the Hebrew Bible. And there's the story you tell I wanted you to talk about. Isaac Shamosh, I guess is his name, and he's this scholar who is sent by these Jewish elders to Aleppo to see if he could secure the book because they want to use it for obviously practical purposes. And the story is interesting about just how protective they were about it. I mean, they wouldn't even let the Codex be photographed.
In 1943, there's a circle of scholars in Jerusalem, which is still under British rule. They're at Hebrew University, and the leading member of this circle is Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who would later be the president. Yeah. But he's also a scholar, an anthropologist, and ethnographer, and he and his colleagues are very interested in this codex because they want to produce a new scientific version of the Hebrew Bible, a perfect version of the Hebrew Bible. And for that, they need this codex. And they decide that they're going to send an envoy to Aleppo and ask for the codex, thinking that that would perhaps be enough. And they send Isaac Shamosh, you mentioned, who's a young lecturer on Arabic literature at Hebrew University, and he himself is a Jew from Aleppo, and that's why he's chosen for the mission, and he travels by train through Lebanon to Aleppo and asks the Aleppo elders, will you send this codex to Jerusalem? And they say, of course not. Yeah. We can never move it from the synagogue. And he returns to Jerusalem without the codex. They send a second envoy that year saying, okay, you don't want to send us the manuscript, but won't you let us photograph it? We can work off photographs. And the elders in Aleppo say, no, this book can never be photographed. The third envoy arrives at the end of 1943. Of course, this is at the height of World War II. There's lots of other stuff going on. He arrives in Aleppo. A Bible scholar named Umberto Casuto, who used to be the chief rabbi of Florence. And he is allowed to sit in the synagogue with the codex for several days under guard. The guards are there to make sure he doesn't abscond with part of the manuscript or take pictures. Yeah. And he's given several days with the manuscript, and he writes down notes. And he doesn't get to see a lot of the manuscript, but those notes are crucial later on when part of the manuscript is lost.
Of course, it's Casuto who writes this obituary after
the riots.
That's right.
It's Casuto who writes the obituary for the Aleppo Codex, which is quite striking if you know his life story. This is a parenthetical aside. In Kasuto, at the time that he was looking at the Aleppo Codex in Aleppo, his son, who had replaced him as chief rabbi in Florence, was in the ghetto in Florence, which was under Nazi occupation. And at that very time, the SS was liquidating the ghetto. And his son and his daughter-in-law and another daughter and her husband, they were sent to Auschwitz. And their children, Kasuto's grandchildren, were being held, were being hidden by Christian families in Florence at this very time. And his son dies in Auschwitz. So Kasuto, who is heartbroken over the loss of the Codex, is a man who knows what real grief is. And that makes his grief over the loss of the book that much more touching.
The Aleppo elders say that, had said at the time that making a copy would render their treasure worthless. Why do they eventually allow it to be smuggled, really? And what did they figure? I guess they figured that there wasn't much of a future for Jews in Syria, which of course came to be true. They were spread throughout the world, as you write about. But is that why they finally decided this can leave Syria?
Yes, they decided that only when they realized they had no choice. It wasn't clear initially after the State of Israel was founded that if this new Jewish state existed, there would be no Jewish communities in Arab countries. That took time to emerge. And by 1957, it's pretty clear there had been about 10,000 Jews in Aleppo in 1947. And by the mid-1950s, there are about 2,000. And by the early 1990s, there are none. The rabbis understand that this is happening, and they know that they have to get this book out before someone else obtains it. So they arrange with a Jew who has been given a very rare exit permit. Jews at the time are not only are they not allowed to leave Syria, they're not allowed to travel between cities in Syria, and their passports are marked with a red stamp that says Jew. This man, a member of the community, a cheese merchant, is given a permit to leave, and the rabbis spy an opportunity, and they bring him the codex, and he hides it in his washing machine, and he smuggles it over the border from Syria into Turkey and from there to Israel.
So, I should take a break because I want to head into the next part of the – it just starts getting more and more interesting, Mari Friedman. And as you're unraveling these layers, do you think there are people who are starting to get you keep meeting with these really shady characters. You come across people and you would never you've talked about how you've never really felt in danger, but you did feel like that, you were in some pretty dicey ground at some places, it seems. It just got to be – it was really – there's a lot of intrigue, I guess I'm saying.
The story was much less straightforward than I thought it was at the beginning, and it certainly took me to places and to people who I would not have met otherwise, whether that's people involved in this very murky trade in ancient books or 90-year-old rabbi is one of my close accomplices in the writing of this book, turned out to be an 80-year-old ex-Mossad agent.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's called The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. Mari Friedman is our guest, and you can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back with the journalist Mari Friedman. We're talking about his book, The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. Here's a question from Rick in Salt Lake City. He says, can you compare the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Aleppo Codex?
The Dead Sea Scrolls predate the Codex by about 1,000 years. Yeah. Just for people who might not be familiar with the scrolls, these are thousands of fragments of many, many different books that are found at a site called Qumran on the Dead Sea in the Judean desert to the east of Jerusalem. They're found beginning in the 1940s. And they are very important for scholars of early Judaism and early Christianity. They include texts of all the books of the Hebrew Bible, except for the book of Esther, and in addition, books related to this sect that appears to have existed at Qumran. Yeah. So the Dead Sea Scrolls have a lot of importance for people who are interested in how the Bible developed. As far as the Jewish religion is concerned, the Aleppo Codex is a far more important manuscript. The Dead Sea Scrolls have no religious significance in Judaism. The Aleppo Codex is the perfect version of the Bible as far as believing Jews are concerned. It's the most accurate version we have of the Word of God. So the Aleppo Codex is a manuscript with a lot of religious significance. The Dead Sea Scrolls are fascinating manuscripts with a lot of historical and scholarly significance.
So after the Aleppo Codex is written in Tiberias, it ends up in Jerusalem. It's stolen by crusaders there. It's ransomed by the Jews of Cairo. And then, I'm not sure where this fits in the story, but about the 12th century, it ends up on the desk of Moses Maimonides, the Jewish great Jewish philosopher and scholar. And this was – he sort of gave it his stamp of approval. I guess it became a really valuable document because Maimonides used it – actually used it in creating his essays and certainly his greatest work.
That's right. Maimonides' importance in Jewish history, his stature as one of the greatest Jewish minds. He was also a famous physician in Cairo, outside of the Jewish community, and he's remembered as a great philosopher in Western thought. But certainly he's remembered as one of the great scholars of Jewish law of the past, maybe past 2,000 years. So if he decides that this codex is the authoritative version of the Bible, that has a lot of power, and that stamp of approval is retained by the Codex to this day. He was the leader of a very wealthy Jewish community in Cairo that no doubt had many, many copies of the books of the Bible, but he chose this one, and he wrote explicitly in his greatest work of Jewish law that the copy he regards as authoritative is this book, which we know as the Aleppo Codex. At that time, it wasn't called the Aleppo Codex because it had not yet arrived in Aleppo. It only arrived in Aleppo in the 14th century. But he certainly gives a very detailed description of the manuscript, so we know he's talking about this Bible. Hmm.
So the Aleppo Codex, as you say, in 1957, it's smuggled out of Aleppo, ends up in Israel, and then it becomes the kind of the focus of this. Of this really interesting Byzantine trial. Israel, I guess, figures now it belongs to Israel and it represents the Jewish people and we're the rightful owner. But the rabbis of Aleppo, as you have said, they didn't see it that way. Talk about the trial as it plays out.
When the manuscript arrives in Israel, it ends up in the hands of the Israeli government. Yeah. And the Jews... The Aleppo Jews who are in Israel, there's a small community of exiles who are already in Israel, they can't quite understand how this happened because, of course, the community had always refused to let this book out of its hands. Right. And suddenly it had become the property of Ben Zvi and his academic institute, a state institute. And Ben Zvi, who was the head of this institute, was also the president of Israel. So it had effectively become property of the state. And they did something very unique for Israel in those years. Israel at the time was run very much by a secular, socialist European establishment, and these Jews from Aleppo were not secular and not socialist and not European. They sued the government. Mm-hmm. They went to a rabbinic court in Jerusalem and sued the government to get their book back. And this fascinating trial that unfolds over the next 4 years theoretically centers on a technical question, which is what did the Aleppo rabbis instruct the courier? You remember the guy with the washing machine?
Yeah, cheese
what
merchant.
Did they instruct the cheese merchant? What did they tell him to do with the manuscript when he arrives in Israel? That's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But underlying that is a far more interesting question, which is who owns Jewish history? And the state of Israel says that it is the incarnation of Jewish history. It represents the Jewish people. So Jews in Aleppo, you might have guarded this book for 600 years and you did a great job and thank you very much. But now that the book is back, it's ours. It belongs to the Jewish people, i.e. the state of Israel, us. And the Jews of Aleppo said, no, this book is called the Aleppo codex because it's ours, and we guarded it for 600 years, and it always protected us. And we did not intend for it to leave our hands, and they hadn't subsumed themselves into the Zionist narrative of Jewish history. And for a while, it was impossible to ascertain the truth because there was no communication between Israel and Syria. So they couldn't ask the rabbis in Aleppo what they intended to do with the manuscript.
Yeah.
But that eventually becomes clear over the course of the trial.
You know, sometimes it's hard to talk about this book because I don't want to give too much away. I mean, people should read it because it's a great mystery. But there is, of course, this question about what happens to portions of it, sections of the Aleppo Codex. And, of course, there's this official version of the story that the manuscript was damaged in those riots in Aleppo. And it had these strange marks on them. And everyone always figured, well, because there was the story was related to it, you know, the synagogue being burned or other sacred texts being burned, that these were burn marks. But that's not what they were. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I love that part of the story. The Aleppo Codex has, to this day, and you can see it in the Israel Museum, on the bottom outer corner of each page, it has a strange purplish mark. Yeah. The pages are eaten away on that corner. And it was thought for many years that that was a burn mark, that the book had been singed in the synagogue fire. The book had been burned, and that explained the disappearance of 200 of its pages. About 40% of the Aleppo Codex is gone, 200 of approximately 500 pages. And those pages include the heart of the manuscript. They include the Torah, the five books of Moses. Those pages vanished sometime in the mid-20th century. So in our times, they didn't vanish in ancient times.
Yeah.
This was a very convenient story, the fire story, because if they were burned, that means you don't have to look for them.
Right.
And this story persists, to some extent, it persists to this day, but it certainly persisted until 1986, which is when the manuscript is taken for restoration for the first time. 30 years after arriving in Israel, it's sent to the Israel Museum, to a restoration lab, and an expert on ancient manuscripts named Michael McGinn thinks these burn marks look funny. They don't strike him as burn marks. And he sends fragments of those marks to a microbiologist at a hospital in Jerusalem, and they run a battery of tests. And scientists in Albany, New York, also run tests on the manuscript. And when the results come back, McGinn, the manuscript expert, told me that he literally jumped out of his chair because what the slides showed quite clearly was that the burn mark was not a burn mark. It was a fungus. And it was a fungus caused most likely by the fact that people were licking their finger and touching the corner of the manuscript, which is a detail right out of The Name of the Rose for those who've read it. And this was a fungus, and there was actually no evidence that the book had ever been burned. And that, of course, ignited or reignited the question of the missing pages, this great mystery of the missing pages. If the book hadn't been burned, then where were these pages?
Yeah.
And for many Bible scholars and manuscript collectors and people involved in that world, the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex are like the Holy Grail.
Well, you mentioned how in the 1980s, two pieces resurface in Brooklyn. No, was it Brooklyn?
Yes, they resurface in an unexpected place. They resurface in Flatbush, in a very Jewish part of Brooklyn, which is heavily settled with exiles from Jewish Aleppo. In the early 1980s, one page, a complete page from the Book of Chronicles surfaces. It's held by a woman, a Jewish woman from Aleppo, who keeps it as a good luck charm. And she sends it back to Jerusalem to join the rest of the manuscript. And in 1986, another fragment is found. And it's a tiny torn piece of a page from the Book of Exodus, from the plague of frogs. And an elderly Jewish man from Aleppo had laminated it and kept it in his wallet as a good luck charm, and he believed that it protected him, just as the Aleppo Jews had always believed that the book protected the community. He believed that it had helped him survive open heart surgery. And while he was willing to show it to scholars, he refused to give it up until he died. And several years ago, when he did die, his family sent the fragment to Jerusalem, and it went on display at the Israel Museum about a month ago for the first time. Those are the only two fragments of the missing pages ever to have surfaced.
Right. Do you figure there's any chance that that book, which was whole for so many hundreds of years, could ever be whole again?
Yes. One of the clear conclusions I draw from my book is that those pages were not burned. Yeah. And they didn't disappear. Things don't disappear in the real world. They're out there, and they're held by someone or by several people. And there are fragments of information that I publish in the book that might point us in the right direction. I think that those pages are there, and I think that one day they will surface. And I hope that the publication of this book will spark new interest in the Aleppo Codex. It'll shake the tree, and maybe interesting information on this mystery will fall out, and maybe in the next weeks or months or years, we'll be lucky enough to see some of these priceless pages resurface and be joined with the rest of the manuscript in Jerusalem.
There's this irony that you write about at the end of the book, your book, how this holy text was, you know, cast about by flawed human beings, and as you put it, really kind of fell victim to the instincts that it was created to temper, which is really interesting. There's this kind of irony with this beautiful, perfect book being handled by imperfect people.
Right, and that's the great irony of the story of the Aleppo Codex, because, of course, ancient artifacts are bought and sold all the time, and, you know, valuable paintings, but they're stolen and, you know, fenced. But what we have here is the book that condemns theft.
Yeah.
It's what the object that is being stolen and lied about and moved around is the very book that tells us not to do those things. And that, of course, is an incredible irony, and it's just an insight into the imperfect nature of who we are.
Mm. Mari Friedman is the author of The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. There are a lot of stories in there that we didn't get to, of course, and of course the mystery and the way it plays out. So you should take a look. Mari Friedman joined us from a studio in Jerusalem. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can visit us at radiowest.kuer.org, where we have a link to Friedman's book and to an interactive online exhibit on the Ben Zvi Institute's website. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our interns are Tim Slover and Matthew Martin. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.